Hello and welcome to Doubleston, Sports Car 365 Sports Car Racing Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Grace, and I'm joined today by our editor-in-chief, John DeGeese, who is covering the IMSA action in Long Beach, and our Asian editor, Jamie Klein, who is following the World Endurance Championship in Imola. John, how did you enjoy your weekend in Southern California?
It was pretty good. We had a really interesting WeatherTech Championship race, a couple good pair of GT America powered by AWS races, so looking forward to breaking it all down.
And Jamie, how was your time in Italy?
Yeah, it was great to be back on European soil for a WEC race. Of course, Italy, the home of Ferrari, the home of Valentino Rossi, of course, as well in the GT3 ranks. So a brilliant crowd, I think 73,000 fans across the 3 days. The weather was a bit up and down, as I'm sure we'll get onto in a moment, but certainly the atmosphere was great. You could really feel the sense of occasion as the WEC arrived in Europe for the first time this year. And we did get a brilliant race, which I'm looking forward to breaking down in detail today.
We've got a packed show for you today. We'll break down all the racing action from the weekend across both sides of the Atlantic, and we'll take a look at some of the week's biggest headlines, and we'll answer a couple of listener questions. All that and more on this week's episode of Doubleston. Well, Jamie, let's dive into covering the 6 hours of Imola, and it didn't end as it began. It was a Ferrari 1-2-3, a pretty perfect start for the Italian Ferrari fans in attendance, but it didn't end up that way. Toyota back in victory lane. Nick De Vries with an amazing restart, jumping the number 50 Ferrari for, at the time, what was for second place, but would have eventually paid dividends down the line, and then a massive final stint from Kamui Kobayashi to hold off a charging Kevin Estre at the end for the win.
Yeah, it was a very up and down race, especially for Ferrari. As you mentioned, they had a 1-2-3 lockout of the grid. The 499P was definitely the quickest car in dry conditions, as we saw in qualifying. And the early part of the race, they didn't maintain the 1-2-3 formation for that long, but certainly it seemed like the 499P had the legs on the hypercar opposition. Toyota probably emerged as the 499P's closest competitor in the dry, at least. It seemed the number 7 car of De Vries, Kobayashi and Mike Conway was definitely emerging as the biggest threat to Ferrari dominance, let's say, until the arrival of rain with about 2 hours to go, which of course ended up flipping things on their head completely. With really the tire strategy and the timing of the switch from slicks to wets, really proving the decisive factor in that. So Ferrari just getting it wrong there. They left all three of their cars, including the number 83 AF Corsa machine, but also, crucially, the two factory cars were all left on slick tires on a track that was getting worse, but not. It wasn't a super heavy rain shower. It was the conditions were bad in sector 3. But for the rest of the lap, it looked manageable. And we even heard on the team radio, the Ferrari drivers were saying they were able to continue on slick tires. But of course, the driver in the cockpit doesn't necessarily have all the information to hand. And it turned out that Toyota's very risk-averse strategy of coming in really at the earliest opportunity with both cars to change them to wet tires, that proved to be the right thing to do. And so in the end, it was Kamui Kobayashi defending from Kevin Estre in the Porsche, the number 6 Porsche Kapensky Motorsport entry, that had also come in early to change to wet tyres. But Kobayashi having to do a lot of fuel saving in the last stint because Toyota had changed to slick tyres, changed to wet tyres early, it kind of put them on a slightly offset strategy. And it just meant that Kobayashi had to save a lot of energy during his final stint as he had Estre getting closer and closer. Estre had a couple of opportunities to make a move, couldn't quite get close enough. Imola proving a very difficult circuit to actually make a proper on-track pass. We didn't really see that many in the hypercar category, at least. So Estre just missing out in the end. But it was a thrilling conclusion to a race that really I don't think anyone would have predicted Toyota taking the victory at the start. But really, it was the rain that gave them the opportunity. They made the most of it. Ferrari dropping the ball. Toyota showing, as has always been the case, really for several seasons, that they are the class of the field when it comes to strategy calls and execution on pit lane.
Well, you mentioned there how tricky Imola was to navigate, and I think there was maybe no better example of that than the start. It was chaotic. You know, we saw Alpine, BMW, Peugeot, and Isotta Fraschini all impacted in the top class, not to mention the chaos in the LMGT3 field. But it started the 6 hours of Imola off with a bit of a bang, and not the type that you would hope to see in a race with a bunch of cars being affected with damage.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a very narrow run down to Tamburello, that kind of first chicane. And of course, we have this huge hypercar field now, everybody jostling for position, knowing that with Imola being such a hard track to pass, that the first lap and the start especially was probably one of their best opportunities to actually gain some positions. And of course, if you're outside the top 10 on the grid, then perhaps there's going to be some drivers who are a little bit more desperate than others to try and use that opportunity to claw back some ground. So as you mentioned, several hypercars getting into each other there. It looked like the trigger was actually the Isotta Fraschini of Jean-Carl Vernet, who got into the back of Mathieu Vaxivière's Alpine. And that in turn collected the Peugeot of Paul de Resta and the BMW of Dries Van Toor. It was the BMW that came off worst because they had to go into the garage for about an hour to repair the suspension. So really that was game over for them. The Alpine also heavily delayed, had to spend a few minutes in the garage as well after a very slow lap back to the pits. The Peugeot losing a little bit less time, and the Isotta Fraschini actually coming out pretty much unscathed apart from some very superficial damage on the nose. The stewards actually ruled Vaxivière was to blame, and that Alpine was actually penalised. But Vernet took the blame for the crash when he was interviewed during the race, and Vaxivière, it seemed, wasn't too happy about being held responsible. But either way, that Alpine car's race was more or less ruined. And just to add insult to injury, the sister Alpine with Charles Malaisie at the wheel was forced to take avoiding action because the BMW spun right in Malaisie's path. So Malaisie more or less dropping to the rear there. It was a very difficult weekend for Alpine anyway. It didn't look like they had the pace at all. But certainly that first corner pretty much ending their hopes of points realistically with either car, BMW losing a car and Peugeot as well on the back foot. So it was a very chaotic start to the race and really set the tone for what we had to come over the course of the 6 hours.
Yeah, and you mentioned Peugeot briefly there, and let's not forget it was the debut of the updated Peugeot 9X8 with the new rear wing, and it seemed by all accounts, and there's a great story up on the website, you can read more about it, that Peugeot felt like this was kind of the best they could do, 9th and 14th in the hypercar class overall when it was said and done. It's not an easy task adjusting to a new format, and for Peugeot, we know all of the changes they've made up and down across the car. It's not just as simple as slapping a rear wing on. It's been a bit of an overhaul for the 9X8, and they're still adjusting to it, so we can forgive them for that. But it seems like from their eyes, they've tried to maximize as much as they could out of this Imola weekend.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to speak to Jean-Éric Vergne after qualifying, who shares the number 93 car with Nico Müller and Mikkel Jensen. Vern was very unhappy with the showing that Peugeot put on in qualifying, only 14th and 15th. Of course, the drivers are not allowed to talk about the balance of performance, but it was clear that Vern felt that the Peugeot was being hampered by its balance performance with the, of course, being a totally new car, a new homologation. They were given new, what they call now homologation parameters, which is basically the starting BOP in layman's terms. And that it's the heaviest car in the field. And considering that it was the lightest car, or one of the lightest cars, certainly in Qatar, where we saw the wingless version of the 9X8 looking so competitive with only a real dash of misfortune at the very end, denying them second place. Clearly, the 9X8 was not the same competitive proposition that it had been in Qatar. Of course, a very different circuit, very bumpy, a lot of curbs. Like you say, the team still getting to grips with the car, but it's clear from the teams speaking to the team personnel and the drivers, they believe it's a big upgrade on the old car, and that in theory it should be possible to do what they did in Qatar at all circuits with the revised version of the car. And clearly the BOP didn't favour them. I'm sure they'll be hoping for some tweaks between now and the next race at Spa. But all that said and done, considering they pretty much lost one car at the start with the incident we just described, I think ninth place wasn't too bad in the end for that 93 car, Verne, Müller and Jensen at the wheel. It seemed like they were probably the fifth or perhaps sixth fastest package on the day. Did gain one or two places late on when some cars hit trouble. So a slightly fortuitous couple of points perhaps, but certainly a solid foundation laid for that car. And the team is convinced that it's going to be a package that's going to be competitive at a wide range of circuits and not just places like Qatar.
It's a point well made, and you've got to imagine that the car is going to advance as they continue to develop it and get more track time and real life testing mileage in the form of race conditions. So we're excited to see what the 9X8 can bring us later in this WEC season. And before we move on, let's touch on LMGT3. It was a pretty darn good day to be behind the wheel of a WRT BMW. A 1-2 for the BMW squad, the 31 and 46, coming across the line in succession. They pretty much nailed the tire strategy, Jamie, electing to stay out on slicks. It was a bit of a different approach in LMGT3 than we saw in the hypercar class. You know, we saw Klaus Backler come in for wets maybe at the wrong time. He says he stands behind Manti Pure Racing's strategy there. You can forgive him for coming in for wet tires, but ultimately, from what WRT showed us, the right move was to stay out on slicks, and that paid dividends at the end.
Yeah, this was a very interesting one because the track being kind of probably two-thirds wet, not quite full wet conditions where it's absolutely require wet tires, no questions asked. We saw the hypercar field, of course, all coming in for wet tires eventually. But there was more of a split in LMGT3. And I think that reflects the fact that these cars just have more mechanical grip and they can kind of get by in slippery conditions a little bit easier than the hypercars. They're not so reliant on downforce. And especially the BMW M4 GT3, I think it's important to note that that is a well-proven package in these kind of conditions. And of course, you have to give credit to Augusto Farfus and Maxime Martin, the respective pros of those cars who were at the wheel when the rain came down, because they have all the experience in the world and they know exactly how to get the best out of the M4. But contrasting with the Manti Pure Racing entry of Klaus Backler, as you mentioned, coming in for wet tires, of course, the Porsche 911 GT3R, being a rear engine car, doesn't have the same kind of heavy front end. And you can imagine that perhaps the driver, Klaus Backler in this case, maybe didn't quite have the same confidence in the wet conditions that Farfus and Martin had driving their BMWs. Completely different types of car. That's what we love about GT racing, that we do get to see different types of car, you know, fundamentally different platforms, able to race against each other. But clearly, the BMW was the car to have in these conditions. Augusto Farfus coming out with the win eventually with alongside Sean Gallet and Darren Leung in just his second WEC start, Darren Leung. So, that a great achievement for the British driver. BMW also scoring its first win in the WEC in any class. Of course, they had the somewhat ill-fated M8 GTE project a few years ago, which sadly didn't yield any class wins in what was the GTE Pro class. So a good milestone for BMW. Maxime Martin coming home for second place in the car he shared with Ahmad Al-Hati, and of course Valentino Rossi. We would be remiss not to mention the doctor, of course, the MotoGP legend, clocking up his first WEC podium on home soil, completing a 1-2 for Team WRT. But Manti Pure Racing, okay, they didn't get it right with the tire call in the end, but Klaus Backler, Alex Malakin and Joel Sturm still coming away with third place. And I think it is also important to mention, we saw that car dominate in Qatar more or less. And I think if this had been a full dry race, I think we would have probably seen that car win again, because Malakin was absolutely imperious in qualifying. Of course, all the bronze drivers have to do qualifying. So it was perhaps no surprise to see Malakin, the class of the field there, and they were eking away from the field, not quite as rapidly as they did in Qatar, a lot more cautions and full course yellows to kind of break up the momentum. But it really did seem to me that they were on course for the win, a bit like Ferrari in the hypercar class. And I'm sure they remain the heavy favorites, I think, for this championship. And they still, of course, lead the championship after two races.
Well, an excellent round in Imola. We were treated to 6 hours of really, really good racing. Jamie, thanks for your help in breaking this one down. Well, John, let's move into talking about the IMSA round in Long Beach, the shortest race of the IMSA season, just 100 minutes, but not short on action, that's for sure. It was the number 01 Chip Ganassi Racing Cadillac who found its way back to victory lane after nearly a year without a victory. You could see the faces in, of everybody, Sebastian Bourdais, Renger van de Zander, Chip Ganassi, everyone involved, how much this meant to them. The Cadillacs looked quick all weekend, but it was tire strategy at the end of the day that made a difference. They did the entire 100-minute race on a single set of Michelin tires, and that allowed them to jump the number 31 Action Express Racing Cadillac and ultimately take the win.
Yeah, it was really interesting, a tactical race for sure. And speaking to Renger van der Zander before the race, prior to the start of On Track Action on Thursday, he was saying, you know, we're going to have to sort of work and find some extra thing to get us up front. And certainly that's what they sort of did with the strategy call to stay on the Michelin Softster for the entire 100-minute race. It wasn't unprecedented because we had that last year with Matthew Jaminet and Nick Tandy in the number 6 Porsche Penske Motorsport entry that did the same thing, except that time IMSA and Michelin were utilizing the medium compound tire, which is a little more robust than the soft, especially when it comes to longer stint length. And talking to people before the race, some people were thinking, oh, maybe it might be possible, might not be possible. Sebastian Bourdais said post-race that they had really looked at it from the session on Friday, a pretty long practice two session that ultimately saw that they were able to sustain the tire deg that they needed over the course of 100 minutes. And that's where the idea sort of came about, but it wasn't executed until quite late into the day, once they saw the weather conditions and whatnot that was sort of at play at the Long Beach Street Circuit. But like you said, Jonathan, the number 31 car of Pippo Durante started on pole, was out front, was one of the first cars to pit. And then we saw Bourdais pit just, I think, one or two laps later and was able to sort of jump out ahead just because of that tire strategy.
And kind of a different race than we saw last year, John. Last year, aside from the caution at the beginning, ran pretty green. This one was dotted with a couple of full course yellows and safety car periods, including a bit of a LA traffic jam at the end, if you will, at the hairpin. It's one of the tightest, I think it is the tightest corner on the IMSA calendar, and it showed. These are big cars. The GTs are big. The prototypes are even bigger, and it impacted a lot. It was the 78 Forte Racing Lamborghini who got into the back of the number 6 Porsche Penske Motorsport, kind of dropped them out of contention and spun Matthew Jaminet, and then everybody had to kind of woe up. The 25 BMW suffered, I think, a little bit of damage, came in, and then Connor DeFilippi ended up finding the tire wall later on. It looked like he had trouble slowing the car down into turn 6, and so that kind of took them out of contention for a decent result. A bit of chaos at the end, but it set up a nice little shootout as Jack Aitken was chasing down Renger van de Zander, but the 01 crew held on for the win. Let's talk about GTD for a second here, because I think that was another interesting one. Vassar Sullivan pretty much dominated out front. It was the number 89 of Parker Thompson and Ben Barnicot who got the job done. Lexus, of course, bringing two cars to have two horses in this fight, but the 12 was taken out of contention a bit early after having to serve a drive-through penalty for changing lanes at the start, meaning it was really just a one-horse race for them. But it was the 89 who led pretty comfortably at the head of the GTD field.
Yeah, it was a flag-to-flag victory for Ben Barnicot and Parker Thompson, who I'd have to say was extremely impressive during the course of the weekend, putting that car on pole and really holding his own during that opening stint. Barnicot said post-race it was one of his more easiest races he's done in his career because he was just sort of out front from the get-go in his stint and brought the 89 car to victory lane. It's real interesting because we saw the number 96 Turner Motorsport BMW gained some time on pit lane. They ended up finishing second ahead of the Team Kortoff, Preston Kortoff Motorsports, Mercedes AMG that completed the podium. But yeah, a real dominant day for the Lexus that wasn't really supposed to be in victory lane, maybe. Pre-race, there was a lot of talk of the emphasis on the number 12 car since they were in the full season entry for the GTD class. The 89 was just added because there was no GTD Pro class this weekend. Ultimately, the drivers, Frankie Montegalvo and Parker Thompson, had to be split up because they needed a silver-rated driver in each car per the regulations. And ultimately, all the talk pre-race was that, you know, the 12 car was probably going to be the favored entry just from a points perspective. And then, unfortunately, Frankie had that drive-through penalty early in the race, right at the start. And then Jack Hawksworth, when he got into the car, ended up rushing the wall and ended up retiring at the end of the race. So a bittersweet day for Vassar Sullivan, but still a win is a win for that crew, who's typically proved by the 14 guys that usually do GTD Pro, but just wearing a different number and a slightly different driver lineup over the weekend.
Yeah, and they did this because there was no GTD Pro. It was just GTP at the top end and then the GTD cars. So none of the top end GTD Pro cars on the streets of Long Beach. And, you know, it's a pretty full GTP grid, so you can understand why. But it was neat. It allowed the GTD cars to kind of shine and have their own little moment in the sun here. And it was an interesting little shakeup of a format. I know some people felt certain ways about it, but, you know, it ended up being a really fun race at the end of the day. Well, John, another interesting talking point I wanted to bring up here, it was tire strategy that kind of won the weekend here, with Goodyear supplying the tires for LMGT3, WRT making good use of their tire strategy. But for Michelin, they supply the tires for the top class in hypercar. Tire strategy helped Toyota to victory lane. Tire strategy helped Chip Ganassi to victory lane. So Michelin's got to be pretty happy here on both sides of the Atlantic.
Yeah, for the top two prototype classes over the weekend, for sure. And it's really interesting when you start opening up the game of strategy, particularly with tires. And I think really kudos to both sanctioning bodies for being really stringent on tire allocations this year. And IMSA was to some degree last year as well. It hasn't really changed much, but WEC has lowered the number of tires used over the course of a weekend this year as well. And I think it certainly helps add more strategy to the things. The tires are in the top classes, in the prototype classes that are the same, but LMGT3, it's a brand new tire. In GTD with the Michelin and the WeatherTech Championship, that's a brand new tire as well. So there's a lot of the play with tire strategies, and always good to see it work out in these kind of ways. It's always an interesting story to tell when it comes down to that.
And the streets of Long Beach were busy this weekend, John. We also had a pair of GT America powered by AWS races in Southern California. It was a pretty darn good weekend to be with CRP Racing. Jason Daskalos ended up sweeping the weekend in his Mercedes-AMG GT3 Evo. A bit of an emotional weekend for that team. You can read about it more on the website, but a really good weekend of GT action. Both races ran completely green, and so they got to just play out and breathe. The two 40-minute sprint races were really, really entertaining to watch. And we had some 24-hour series action as well over in Europe. The 12 hours of Spa, where CP Racing came out on top in its final Creventec outing. As always, you can read all about the races we've covered in today's show and more in more detail over on sportscar365.com. Well, John, let's dive into covering some of the big news headlines for this week. And the biggest one here is that Jota might be in contention for a factory Cadillac hypercar deal in 2025. Chip Ganassi Racing is not returning next year in IMSA or the WEC to run the Cadillac V-Series.R. So that leaves a bit of a big gap here, and Jota might be the favorite here. Nothing is confirmed, and so it's all kind of speculative at the moment. But, John, we've had multiple industry sources indicate that this might be a possibility here. And Jota would be a pretty darn good pick.
Yeah, they would be. And it's a real interesting one because right now, obviously, they run the pair of Hertz-sponsored Porsche 963s. They are a privateer team, let's be clear. And every privateer team's aspiration, most of them at least, is to become a factory team. And this would be quite an opportunity for Sam Hignett and David Clark, who co-own the Jota organization. They've been one of the benchmark privateers through the years, and certainly getting on the podium in Qatar with the 963 for the first time. That was a real shining moment. Unfortunately, they had a bit of a challenging weekend in Italy, but nonetheless, this is what we're hearing right now, that they're in contention, at least for the factory Cadillac hypercar program, which will likely expand to two cars. Because there is a mandate likely to be approved in the next month by the teams in the WEC that'll mandate each manufacturer to run two cars per manufacturer in the top class of in hypercar competition. So interesting because Jota could end up carrying over sponsorship with Hertz. We know Hertz has a commercial agreement with GM, and there's a lot of tie-ins there. Cadillac had only run one car in the hypercar class full season the last two seasons because of budget reasons. We know that was clear. So this could sort of help kill two birds with one stone by going with a team like Jota. Again, like you said, Jonathan, it's still not confirmed. We probably won't have a final decision from GM until around Le Mans time. That's what I've heard from multiple sources. There are, or have been at least, some other teams that have been in contention as well, European-based outfits. It looks pretty clear that that's the direction GM wants to go, at least with this, instead of building up a team like they did with this Chip Ganassi Racing outpost in Germany over the last two seasons. Didn't really work out the best. Maybe, you know, budget reasons also probably limited the amount of resources they were able to put at it compared to some of the other teams. So interesting times for sure in the top class of the WEC, and we'll see if this actually comes to fruition.
Yeah, well, you better believe we're going to be following this one closely, and we'll bring you any updates as we receive them as well. So stay tuned to Sports Car 365 for that. We'll be keeping our ear to the ground where this is concerned. Let's throw some other quick headlines at you before we move on with the show. And we've got some lineup news regarding the WEC and some clashes with other championships. Andrea Caldarelli will be replacing Eduardo Mortara for the 6 hours of Spa in the Lamborghini SE63. That's due to a Formula E clash in Berlin that Mortara will be participating in. That same Formula E round will be impacting Kelvin Vandalinde, with Rotomo Miata replacing him at Spa as well in the number 78 Akotis ASP Lexus. And Ford has unveiled a Champions Spirit livery for IMSA rounds at Laguna Seca and in Detroit. This is all in celebration of the Mustang's 60th anniversary. The livery is part art car, part heritage livery, paying homage to some of the most prominent and successful Mustangs that have raced on U.S. soil in the past, and it's a stunner. So be sure to look at the pictures and read more about it and some of the cars that have inspired it in the article on sportscar365.com. And you can read more about all the stories we've covered today on the website, and we encourage you to check out Sports Car 365 Plus as well for more detailed and in-depth information coming your way each month. Well, John, let's answer a couple listener questions here. We'll start with two that have come in the comment section of our previous double stint episode. The first from IMSA WEC New Zealand, who asks, what are your thoughts on Vanwall pushing ahead with the revising their hypercar hopes, getting back on the WEC grid? I believe they're working on integrating the same engine that Glickenhaus used during their time in the WEC, wanting to run two cars as well. And, you know, Vanwall obviously not on the grid this year due to some of their struggles, and we've talked about that, you know, on the website and in the podcast as well. It would be interesting to see them back, and we hope that if they do come back, they are able to integrate a package that would allow them to be competitive. That's kind of the name of the game. If someone shows up, you want them to be able to fight and be competitive. But John, do you have any information as far as this one's concerned?
Yeah, certainly they're working on being back on the grid. That's if they get entries. And I think that's the biggest question of it all, because they had put up at least one entry request for this year and were denied. We were, I think, the first to actually break the news that they were switching to the Pipo motor, the same power plant that Glickenhaus had used in their hypercar over the last couple of years. Ultimately, progress has been made on that front, and we'll have to wait and see what happens with this. You know, the hypercar class is going to have a huge grid next year, adding the Aston Martins to the field. And then if this two-car rule comes into effect, you're going to have two Lamborghinis and two Cadillacs and everything like that. You know, Proton wants to expand to a two-car effort as well. So in terms of space, you know, I don't know if it's actually going to be possible, but you have to tip the hat to Colin Collis and everybody at Vanwall for still trying to keep their hopes alive of being back on the WEC grid. Certainly their previous engine partner had done everything they could to get as much out of that power plant as possible, but it just wasn't a realistic expectation for the hypercar class. And I know there were some races they were significantly down on power, and it's a shame that led to their lack of competitiveness and probably led to them not getting the entries for this year. So if they're able to maybe do some test sessions, prove to the FIA and ACO that They do have a much more competitive package with the Pipo motor. Maybe there's an opportunity there, but again, we're going to have to wait and see.
And we've got a couple of questions here from Matthew, also in the comments section of the previous podcast, saying, thank you for the great podcast and making sports car racing more accessible to new fans like me. Well, thank you for the kind words, and we're always glad to have new fans. That's part of what we're all about here in trying to grow the sport as much as we can. So thanks for following along. We appreciate it. And the questions are, first, will there be a showcase or experimental entry at this year's 24 Hours of Le Mans like last year with the Garage 56 NASCAR? We have the Le Mans entry list out, and it doesn't look like there is one as it stands. If anything changes, we'll let you know, but the Garage 56 was a really fun one last year as the independent experimental entry, but unfortunately I don't think we'll see one this season.
Correct. Yeah, no plans for one this year. Not sure if there's one in the pipeline for next year even. I know there's been a lot of talk of a hydrogen powered car or class, obviously launching at Le Mans and the WEC, and the easy transition to that would have to be a hydrogen-powered car compete in Garage 56, but we're told that's not the plan right now from the ACO, at least for their H24 project that they use for some exhibition and some competition in the LMS and Michelin Le Mans Cup. So at least for the foreseeable future, we don't see a project on the horizon, but I guess that could change, but certainly not for this year.
And we will get to see some hydrogen cars showcased both at Spa and ahead of the 24 Hours of Le Mans this year as well, just to show the capabilities of some of the technology. But like you said, John, no experimental entry for this year. The second question, will McLaren, being the only constructor to have won the Triple Crown, Monaco, the Indy 500, and the 24 Hours of Le Mans, and their current programs in F1 and IndyCar, will they join the hypercar grid to complete the set? That's an interesting question, because I think it's been a point of speculation and rumor throughout the last, I would say solid year now. Will they? Won't they? Nothing's confirmed, but I think there are maybe some rumors of a possibility. Again, want to stress, nothing is confirmed. We don't know. If we knew, we would share it with you in an article, but it would be really cool to see them on the WEC grid or the IMSA grid or whatever platform or whatever type of racing they want to do. To see them build a top level prototype would be pretty cool, John.
Yeah, and Zach Brown's openly talked about this, probably dating back to 2020, even before the launch of the LMDH platform. They were really gung-ho on doing this. They have a lot of programs currently that they're involved with Formula E, F1, IndyCar, I believe Extreme E as well to some extent. So lots going on at McLaren, and we'll see if something happens. I know there's been some more talk about it in recent months of whether maybe it could happen, but let's just sort of wait and see.
And the final question here, and John, you mentioned the Aston Martin just a little while ago, asking, the Aston Martin Valkyrie was not originally designed to be a prototype racer. Will join the grid next year. Does this mean we'll see other next-gen supercars be converted and brought to IMSA or the WEC, like the Mercedes AMG 1 or the Bugatti Bolide? That's an interesting one, too. We don't know. Nothing's confirmed. Obviously, Mercedes has a presence with GT3 racing. They do not have a top-level prototype as it stands, and Bugatti is not present on the grid in sports car racing at the moment, but they do have those kind of next-gen supercars built that would kind of compete in the same road car class, I suppose, as the Aston Martin Valkyrie and Valhalla. So it's an interesting question, a point well made. John, what are your thoughts on this one?
I think it's pretty unlikely we would see any road car based hypercars in the top class other than the Aston Martin, which we believe is still being based more or less on the road car, or maybe being based largely on the AMR Pro track day special car. Just hearing the talk of costs and things costing a lot more than expected, especially with that Aston program. I think that's probably going to deter other manufacturers from taking that route specifically. We know Mercedes AMG would like to be in the top class, but I think if they were to go that route, they would probably be doing it with an LMDH car or an LMH car based on a prototype design, just from a cost perspective, because it's significantly cheaper to go do that than basically use an existing race car and adapt it to the hypercar regulations.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think with the AMG One as well, just the design of the car, you know, to use essentially a Formula One power plant for sports car racing would be no easy task, which I'm sure you do know about the road car, how often you have to change mechanical components in that car. It would be a huge challenge. And I think with the Bugatti as well, it does look very prototypey for sure. But we haven't heard anything as of yet. And it would also be a massive challenge. It would be fun, though. And I know we're really, really looking forward to that Aston Martin. I think it's a car that I'm particularly excited about. So thank you for your questions. We always appreciate you writing them in, and we love answering them here on the show. And remember, if you've got a burning question that you'd like us to answer on Double Stint, be sure to put it in the comment section below this episode, and we'll put our heads together to answer it in an upcoming episode. Before we let you go, we'll give you a preview of what's coming up here. DTM will be at Aschersleben for a pair of rounds this weekend, so be sure to stay tuned to Sportscar 365 to catch all of the action with the German Touring Car Championship. Well, that'll do it for us this week on the podcast. If you've got the time, we'd greatly appreciate a rating and review on your podcatcher of choice. It really helps out the show. Thanks so much for joining us wherever you're tuning in from. For John DeGeese and Jamie Klein, I'm Jonathan Grace. We'll see you right back here next week for another edition of Double Stint.